Last week on the show, my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt started telling us about an economic quest he'd been on for years, and he finally found a way to get there by using the mountains of data generated by the ride-sharing company Uber. Levitt's quest? To identify, in the wild, not just in an econ textbook, a real-life demand curve. There were two reasons for this.
One is that once you know the demand curve, it tells the people who are producing, the suppliers, it tells them what the right price is for them to charge. Okay, and that's how people usually think about demand curves and why they're important.
But for those of us who aren't suppliers, for those of us who are just consumers, there's another reason to be excited about the demand curve.
If you know the demand curve, then you know how much consumer surplus there is.
Consumer surplus meaning?
The extra happiness, utility, joy, willingness to pay that a consumer derives from being able to purchase a good at a given price.
Got it. So on today's show, how much consumer surplus does Uber create? And why should you care? That's coming up right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Economists have been talking about consumer surplus for a couple centuries.
So some French guy named Dupuy.
As in Jules Dupuy, a 19th century economist and hydraulic engineer who helped build the sewer system of Paris.
Honestly, I'd never heard of him until I started trying to figure out who invented the concept of consumer surplus. Back in the 1840s, he came up with the idea. So when you're a consumer and you go to buy something, you have to pay a certain price. Let's talk about apples.
Okay, let's. Let's say you go to the grocery store or the farmer's market to buy some apples. You happen to want 4 apples, and you'd be willing to pay $1 each, $4 total. But the apples only cost 50 cents each. So the 4 apples cost you $2 instead of $4. The $2 that you saved from what you would have been willing to pay, that is consumer surplus.
And consumer surplus is one of the most important things in economics. One of the incredible beauties of the market system is that for so much of what we buy, we would have been willing to pay way more for it than we actually have to. We simply have no good ways to measure consumer surplus because we know what people pay. We can sometimes see that, observe how much they buy, but we never see what's inside their head, what their joy is, what they would be willing to pay. If you really were going to estimate consumer surplus, what you would want to do is you'd want to take a consumer and somehow magically you want to reproduce that consumer in 10 parallel universes.
Meaning you'd put the same person in 10 different universes with different prices for the same good. So in universe 1, apples would cost $1 a piece. In universe 2, $2, and so on. At some point, you would find the universe where that consumer refuses to buy the apple. Maybe the universe where it costs $8.
And you would use that fact to say, well, an apple was worth something like, say, $7.50. And so the difference between what they paid and the $7.50, that would be the consumer surplus.
But I would assume that consumer surplus, even on the same good from the same person, is dynamic only because demand is dynamic, right? I might really want 4 apples today and tomorrow I'm sick of apples. How do you factor that in when you're trying to measure overall consumer surplus?
So basically, Dubner, you're on fire today.
You're really?
Asking all the right questions. What's gotten into you? No, it's exactly right. So for a given person, how much they value an apple will be different today, tomorrow, how hungry they are, whether they have a pile of apples at home. And so in essence, you'd want to do this miracle parallel universe experiment over and over and over and kind of add it up over consumers and over time. I mean, all of this, of course, is too difficult to do. And that's why in the last 250 years, we haven't really had any good estimates of consumer surplus.
How does Uber and the way that the business is run allow you to do that in a way that, let's say, asking people going to the grocery store to buy apples wouldn't?
So there are two perfect things about Uber that allow an economist to measure consumer surplus. The first is that they have surge pricing. So anyone who's taken Uber understands that sometimes when you open up the app, you see that Uber is much more expensive than other times. And that happens when there's too much demand and not enough supply of drivers.
If you've never used Uber, here's what you need to know. When you open the app to summon a car, it'll show you in big, bold numbers whether surge pricing is in effect. That is, whether Uber is charging more than the regular fare because of a demand spike. You might see 1.2x, which means the price will be 20% higher. If there's a huge spike in demand, maybe a rainy Saturday night, you might see 3x or even higher, meaning the ride will cost you three times or more the standard fare for that ride. So, the Uber data that Levitt got hold of reflected all that, but one more thing, too. It also showed when someone opened the app and saw the surge pricing and then didn't make the purchase.
And so, why is that important? Because the key to estimating a demand curve is having the same consumer or similar consumers face very different prices. Okay? And so what our strategy boils down to in the end is we try to find similar consumers, and one of them opens the app and indeed sees the regular price, surge equals one, and another consumer who otherwise is essentially identical to that first consumer, they open the app and surge is, say, two times. So the price of a trip is twice as expensive for one person as the other. And we then compute how often does someone actually take the trip and pay for the trip when they see the regular price versus when they see a price which is a two-time surge.
So that's a lot like the thought experiment we did before with the apples and parallel universes.
Except now we're actually seeing it on a massive scale, you know, with millions and millions of people using Uber, and we see radical difference in prices. Now, that's the first element, and that's really good. But there's something even better and hidden inside of Uber that people aren't aware of. And we have your and my good friend, Keith Chen. So Keith has built an algorithm that basically tells him exactly what he thinks the right surge price would be. But to keep things simple for customers, they only have regular price, surge equal to one. And then sometimes it will be 1.2 or 1.3 or 1.4, but they always do rounding. So if they predict that you're like 1.25001, then they show you 1.3. If they predict that it's a 1.24999, they show you 1.2. So literally the consumers who are almost identical.
So you and I could be standing on the same street corner calling two Ubers to go to the same place, and you might get 1.3 surge price and I might get 1.2?
So that wouldn't actually happen because it's not literally done like you and I are standing next to each other. But it might be that you and I are 30 minutes apart and things have changed just the tiniest bit, and that leads to a big jump in the prices. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that discontinuity is the kind of thing, a natural experiment, the kind of thing that economists, especially economists like me, look for all the time because it's two people who are essentially identical but are shown very different prices almost by chance because of the business rule that Uber uses because they don't want to show people complicated in-between prices.
The only reason that doesn't make sense is that when you're talking about the randomness, it sounds like the random choice is between, let's say, 1.3 and 1.2, which is not the big difference. It's not the difference between 3x and 1x. So how does that small rounding up or rounding down help accomplish the bigger goal?
Tubner, that's another amazingly perfect question. You had your economics Wheaties this morning. You're exactly right. So what we do is we use a series of little discontinuities. So between 1.2 and 1.3 and 1.3 and 1.4 and 2.4 and 2.5, we use a series of little tiny breaks. Okay, they're small relative to going from 1 to 5, but each of them, we have so much data. We have so many millions of observations that at each of those separate discontinuities, we can estimate the sensitivity of consumers to changes in price. And what we do is we actually build up little by little by little, at little steps, tiny 0.1 steps, the entire demand curve up from price equals 1 to price equals, you know, 5 times as high.
This is what you call in the paper regression discontinuity analysis?
Exactly. So regression discontinuity is really a way of finding discrete jumps or breaks or changes that otherwise similar people are exposed to different things. And so in our case, we have something like 25 of these little discontinuities. And when you cobble together all of those 25 little natural experiments, what you have at the end is maybe the best representation of a demand curve that anyone's ever had in the real world.
Levitt, talk for just a second about surge pricing generally as an economic concept. So let's say there's a big storm forecast and a hardware store triples the price of flashlights and batteries, which in a lot of places is not allowed. There are what are called anti-gouging laws, and people get really upset about that. But how does that kind of price spike look to an economist and not someone who's just wanting to buy a flashlight?
So economists don't mind those kind of price spikes at all because higher prices make more Uber drivers stay on the road or get on the road. In general, when there's a lot of demand for something, it's great to let the price rise because that stimulates supply and makes everybody better off.
So I'm curious to know, A, what you were expecting to find in terms of consumer surplus, and then B, what you did find.
So I was certainly expecting to find a really big number for consumer surplus. And why is that? Well, because when you talk to people about Uber, they love it. People say, I love Uber. I don't take taxi cabs anymore. And that is a very strong sign that people are really willing to pay more. So I certainly expected to find that there was a lot of consumer surplus. What did we find? Well, that's exactly what we found. In 2015, if you extrapolate to the whole U.S., we found that the overall consumer surplus added up to almost $7 billion. So people spent about $4 billion on Ubers, but they actually would have been willing to spend about $11 billion. So for every dollar people spend on Uber, they got about $1.50 worth of extra joy that they would have been willing to pay on average above and beyond what they did pay. And to put into context just how big this consumer surplus is, the total amount of money that went to what Uber calls the driver partners, the people who are driving the cars, was something like $2.5 billion. So the consumers got more than twice the benefit of all the money that went to the drivers. And Uber itself only got to keep about $1 billion. So if you look at the amount that Uber, the company, kept relative to the amount that the consumers got to keep six times as much.
Now, to be clear, that consumer surplus is spread out over many more consumers than there are Uber stakeholders, or for that matter, drivers. But Levitt's finding would seem to provide ammunition for Uber itself and others who want to promote ride sharing and other resource sharing services like Airbnb. So if I'm Uber, I have your study in hand and I say, hey, Steve Levitt says we're creating $7 billion in consumer surplus in the U.S. alone in 1 year. That would seem to be the hammer with which I could smash all government resistance to Uber. So how do you think about this piece of research and research like this affecting policy?
So I don't know if it's the hammer that changes everything, but for me, I think it should change the discussion. To date, the discussion about Uber has almost always revolved around the idea that there are people who are hurt by Uber, and those would be in particular the taxicab medallion owners, okay? And they're clearly hurt by Uber because they own an asset. They own a monopoly right to control how many cars on the street are allowed to drive people around. But the people who, without a doubt, are being absolutely crushed by Uber are the people who own the taxicab medallions. And there's just no way to get around that. They are the losers. And that is the nature of a market economy, is that when a new technology comes in that turns out to be a lot better for matching customers to vehicles to drive them around, and that breaks a monopoly, that those people will lose, and they will lose badly. And of course, they'll be very loud. Nobody likes to be the one who loses. But I think in this case, it's really inevitable. It's very hard to see any other future path other than medallions not being worth very much.
However, Uber is also working toward eliminating drivers completely. Like just about every other automotive or transportation company on Earth, it is moving as fast as it can toward autonomous vehicles. Uber recently started offering rides in Pittsburgh, San Francisco, and Tempe, Arizona, in cars that drive themselves. Jonathan Hall, an economist who works for Uber, imagines wide-ranging consequences.
The first is that the cost of getting from point A to point B will be much lower. without paying somebody to drive the car, the cost of the ride will be lower. And so people will be encouraged to, rather than own their own cars, use services like Uber to get around. I think the more exciting opportunity than just that is that it will unlock a large number of people from, instead of driving in circles, doing other more productive things.
What kind of productive things?
I can't see the future, but we have exciting pilot programs that we've done. For example, Uber Flew, which we've done a few times, where people in Ubers are dropped off to deliver flu shots. So I think that you'll see that lots of services that are not currently delivered in home will start to be delivered in home because of the low cost of delivering them.
So that might sound appealing from Uber's perspective, and maybe yours too, but replacing all those human drivers with autonomous cars, well, that is part of a much larger and thornier conversation about technology and jobs, a conversation we've been having pretty regularly on Freakonomics Radio. For just a couple examples, you could check out an episode called How Safe Is Your Job? Or the one called The Future Probably Isn't As Scary As You Think. We also made an episode called Regulate This, which is about how companies like Uber and Airbnb are fighting government regulators. The other tricky part about predicting the future, like whether Uber Flew would even be viable, is that, well, it's hard to predict something like consumer demand. Remember, economists haven't even been very good at measuring the existing demand curve. That's what got Steve Levitt excited about the Uber data in the first place, and it worked. So it sounds like you found the unicorn or climbed Mount Olympus, whatever. You've found in the natural world the perfect demand curve, yes?
I wish that that were really true. We have estimated really, really well a demand curve. The only sad part about this, okay, I'm so excited to have estimated a demand curve, is that it's actually not the demand curve I wanted to estimate at all. It's the only one I could estimate, but not the one I really wanted. So for public policy, like in deciding how to regulate Uber, for instance, the demand curve you'd love to have is what we'd call a long-term demand curve. So we want to know how consumers would respond over the course of, say, 6 months or a year to changes in the pricing of Uber. And that would give them time to respond and make other kinds of accommodations if Uber either got more expensive or less expensive. The actual demand curve we estimate is really almost like you call it an instantaneous demand curve. Okay, I open the app, I either buy it or not.
Talk for a minute about how surge pricing with Uber affects demand. How much does it fall, if at all, between 1.2 times normal and 1.5 times normal? What's the shape of that decline?
So the elasticity of demand that we estimate overall turns out to be a number, which is like a negative 0.6 or negative 0.7. So what does that mean? That means that when the price of Uber, say, doubles, it means that the demand for Uber only falls by about 40%. So that is what an economist calls inelastic demand. And inelastic demand is a sign that people are not very sensitive to price.
That would suggest to me, again, not being an economist, that what you're trying to use price hikes for is to create an equilibrium, right? To have supply meet demand in the right place where you want it to be. So that sounds like you're not getting there. Uber's not getting there. Does that imply that surge pricing is just not going high enough to create the equilibrium? And if so, is that just out of public relations that it doesn't go higher?
So it would be easier for Uber if supply and demand were really responsive, because then they would hardly have to change prices and everything would equilibrate. And so the reason we see such big swings sometimes in surge pricing is exactly because the drivers and the users are actually not very sensitive to price. And so it's not that they can't get to equilibrium. It's just that to get to equilibrium, there have to be wilder swings in prices mm-hmm. than would otherwise be the case. But I think the belief is that they actually do get to equilibrium. And I think Uber would love it if they could get to equilibrium by charging 1.2 surge instead of 3.5 surge. But it's just a fact of life that when people aren't that responsive, you need really big changes in price to get the job done.
All of which points to the fact that there's a huge amount of consumer surplus being created, right? I mean, that's the real story.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So when people are willing to pay a lot more, it means they're getting a lot of benefit. And that's exactly what you see.
But there's one huge wrinkle to think about with all that consumer surplus enjoyed by Uber customers. Uber's financials, both official ones and leaked ones, indicate the company is losing at least a couple billion dollars a year. Most of that came from subsidies the company pays its drivers. How long can something like that go on? Well, for a privately owned company with an estimated valuation of nearly $70 billion, probably quite a while, but not forever. Which means that Uber may well have to raise prices to cover that shortfall, which would probably begin to chip away at that massive consumer surplus that Steve Levitt and his colleagues found. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, a conversation with Christine Lagarde, head of the International Monetary Fund. We'll hear how Lagarde treats IMF members who don't follow the rules.
We warn the authorities that this is not acceptable and that expedited measures must be taken to keep the bus on the road.
And we'll talk about economic policymaking and gender.
If Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters, it would be a different story.
And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
As head of an institution with 189 member countries and about $1 trillion at its disposal, Christine Lagarde has a pretty busy schedule. So you can't be too surprised or upset when she shows up a half hour late for an interview.
I would like to apologize to you because I know we've been delaying and postponing, and I offer total apologies. It's my fault.
Since 2011, Lagarde has been running the International Monetary Fund. It's been an eventful era, to say the least. The aftermath of a crippling recession, a European debt crisis, and a global productivity slowdown, populist uprisings that are based, ostensibly at least, on economic distress. So we were pleased when one day last fall, she agreed to squeeze us in for a 45-minute interview.
Can we say 40 rather than 45? Because I'm due to spend time with the World Bank with their board, and I don't want to offend them too much.
They're not so important. Come on. Who would you rather spend time talking to, Freakonomics Radio or the World Bank? Let's be honest here. All right. So can you describe what you actually do in a given or typical day?
Okay. I spend about 50% of my time at headquarters here in Washington and 50% of my time traveling to member countries, because the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has 189 members that are countries that occasionally will request my presence, and I have to attend those G20, G7, and various meetings around the world. So any given day in Washington, I would typically get up very early at about 5-ish in the morning. I do exercise on a daily basis when I'm in Washington. Then after that, shower, breakfast, things like that, and I walk to the office when it's not raining. My day at the office can be anywhere between typically 8 o'clock until about 8 o'clock or sometimes a bit later. And I will, allocate my time between meetings with teams or with heads of department or with the board. I do a bit of reading of materials, and I spend quite a bit of time as well on the telephone talking to either ministers of finance from different countries around the world or leaders of countries where we are trying to help and provide services.
You were born in Paris to two professors. Your mother taught French, Latin, and ancient Greek. Your father, English literature. I also understand you were a talented synchronized swimmer and were on the French national team. So how did that person, the daughter of those professors and the synchronized swimmer, turn into the managing director of the International Monetary Fund?
Well, unfortunately, none of my parents is actually here to see it, and I'm sure they would both be pleased about that. But, I owe it to them and to many other people along the way. But, it's certainly the love and confidence that they have given me, as well as the appetite for reading, exploring, being open to other countries and other languages. That was certainly through my father. And I am where I am. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of determination, a lot of reading over the course of my life, and certainly the confidence to sometimes take the lead, to sometimes say yes, to sometimes say no, and try to carry the team with you along, that I think is predominantly generated by the love that I've received.
The IMF's founding fathers, as Lagarde has called them, were the British economist John Maynard Keynes and the American Treasury official Harry Dexter White. They wanted an institution that would promote a stable international monetary system and help create an economic network that would incentivize peace.
Delegates to this monetary and financial conference pose on the hotel lawn. These meetings are...
It was just after the Second World War, and everybody at the time thought that it would be much better to have a multilateral dialogue rather than go to war.
Right, and this goes back to Bretton Woods, yes?
Yeah, Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, 1944.
At Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference.
In 44 countries deciding that talking, sharing, opening up was better than closing down and entering into war.
Now, most people who think about the IMF, which is probably not that many people on a daily basis, but when we do,
granted,
we usually think about you in moments of fiscal crisis in some country that we probably don't really know that much about, maybe not even know where it is. But obviously, the IMF does a lot more than that. You are the so-called lender of last resort, but also you monitor the economies of nation states around the world, and you engage in what you call capacity development. Can you talk for just a moment about, you know, toggling between the crisis management and the kind of growth development that that the IMF also does?
Yeah. So the mission is about improving financial stability and prosperity. As a result of that, we are engaged in three lines of business. The one that you mentioned first, which is the one that we are best known for because it's more visible, is the lending of last resort when those countries cannot finance or refinance themselves on the markets because their situation is very bad. And in that case, we lend international community money in consideration for commitment on the part of that country that receives the loan to actually fix its public finances, take some necessary measures to restore its financial stability and be able to yet again access markets. So we enter into those agreements on a short-term basis with sometimes difficult measures that have to be taken rapidly, which is often called austerity. But in my view, it's more like discipline that should have been observed in the years before and that we have to help the government in place administer and implement so that the country can again become independent financially and economically.
There is complaining, of course, in retrospect. A lot of countries where the IMF intervenes as the lender of last resort, often they end up being resentful of the terms that are imposed on them. As you noted, you know, you're prescribing medicine that they should have been taking for years and they weren't, and that's why it's come to that. Can you talk about that tension of you as an agency that is the backstop for countries like that, but also trying to build better practices?
Yeah. You know, first observation is that for a program to succeed, so for that discipline to be restored, it takes ownership and support by the authorities. And in many instances where that support is available and the program is endorsed and implemented by the authorities because it's theirs and in the interest of their population, it very often works, and it certainly works better in all circumstances. Second point, there is a bit of a pattern where shortly after the program has been completed and the situation has improved and growth comes back and the country can go back to markets, there is a time period during which there is resentment against the sort of the emergency doctor that came in and said, you really need to operate here and there and do this and that. And then it's followed by a realization that actually that was needed. And that resentment gradually phases out. We've seen, you know, I have seen that on the ground in Latin American countries, most of them, not all of them. I've seen it more and more in Asia Pacific. And hopefully I will see it during my lifetime, hopefully as a managing director, who knows, with Europe.
But let me ask you this. Sometimes there's, you know, bad policy or just an unwillingness to take the medicine all along or bad practices, which may be unintentional. But a lot of the malfeasance is, well, it's malfeasance. So let's talk for a moment about bribery and corruption and how much that is a root cause of the problems that you eventually are called in to mop up. So you recently put the annual global cost of bribery at roughly $2 trillion, about 2% of global GDP. And those are just the hard costs, not counting knock-on effects. But additionally, as we speak, just today, you publicly announced that you're delaying a $17.5 billion bailout package to Ukraine for failing to fight political corruption. So talk to me about how much of what you're addressing is kind of after-the-fact disaster created not by people who don't quite know how to run a central bank or run an economy, and more created by a handful of really bad actors.
Well, there are unfortunately several instances where, surprise, surprise, we find out that such and such loan agreement had not been disclosed, or such and such operation that should have involved public finance has been operated on the side in a special purpose vehicle that has remained undisclosed. When that happens, clearly there has been either deliberate misrepresentation or convenient omittance. In that case, we just suspend the program and we say no more disbursement will be available until these issues have been cleared, until there is complete transparency, and until there is a real dialogue and explanation provided to the international community through us. That happens, and I think that we as an institution committing international money, we have to be extremely firm and uncompromising about it. That's point number one. Point number two, there are programs, and you've just mentioned Ukraine, where one of the key commitments was to set up an institution and to set up a court and to organize a process by which corruption would be identified, would be investigated in accordance with the rule of law and with due process, so that it could be sanctioned eventually if proven and measures been taken. When we see that these commitments are slow in the making, that there is delay that is affecting the delivery of the commitments, same thing. We warn the authorities that this is not acceptable and that expedited measures must be taken to keep the bus on the road, absent which disbursements are no longer available. And I'm pleased to see that apparently the president of Ukraine is today taking the steps to keep the bus on the road, and mm-hmm. we will be very vigilant. Now, the third point is we have, as an institution, always cared about these corruption issues because they are a cancer that actually cripples economies and discourage people from joining forces, contributing value, and doing the right things. And we think that this is just hurting both the financial stability and the prosperity that are our mission. And we have in particular provided a lot of technical assistance on anti-money laundering and on countering the financing of terrorism. And we have specific services, technical assistance, training made available, and a very close collaboration with FATF, which is the international institution in charge of fighting that. We are going to be sort of stronger and deeper into these issues because I'm personally, and I think the board is now supporting this, very frustrated with the fact that we engage, we enter into dialogue, we commit resources, our people work on the ground. And if it is, you know, to discover that there are undisclosed loans, that there is fiddling with the accounts, then it's really not fair on the international community and not fair for the population and not in compliance with our mission.
The IMF, over the decades, has had plenty of critics, even just among economists. Milton Friedman wanted to abolish it. He argued the IMF had outlived its original mission of supporting the global monetary system. It became, he said in 1991, a relief agency for backward countries and proceeded to dig deeper into the pockets of its sponsors to finance its new activities. And that, he said, was the mission of the World Bank, the IMF's sister institution, which was also founded in 1944 at Bretton Woods. Here's what Friedman said, quote, "Now you have two agencies to promote development, both of them, in my opinion, doing far more harm than good." Friedman's point was that government was generally more of an impediment to free markets than a help. But institutions like the IMF and World Bank also create what economists call moral hazard. That is, you're more likely to engage in risky or reckless behavior when you know someone is there to rescue you. Meanwhile, economists on the other end of the spectrum, Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman, for instance, they argued that the IMF promoted an agenda that wasn't interventionist enough. The IMF was criticized for pushing what was called the Washington Consensus, a one-size-fits-all reform model promoting free trade and capital flows, deficit reduction, privatization, and the slashing of subsidies. More recently, the IMF's most controversial bailout was the Greek tragedy. It began before Christine Lagarde's arrival, but has continued to haunt the agency and her, with the IMF accused of everything from complacency and poor due diligence to demanding measures of compliance that are hopelessly unrealistic. So you can see why the IMF might be eager to reposition itself as something more than the lender of last resort, which can feel like a lose-lose proposition. Indeed, in a 2014 speech to Latin American leaders, Lagarde declared that this is, quote, "not your grandmother's IMF." She has stressed the importance of policy issues like climate change, inequality, and helping out the losers in the free trade game. This means, theoretically, less bailout work and more preventive work, the IMF's second line of business, which it calls surveillance.
And countries commit to each other through us to be audited, if you will, and receive recommendations that they typically should observe if they want to improve their situation. So that's the surveillance line of business, and we do that with 189 countries. The third line of business is the one that has most recently developed and developed the fastest, and that is what is called capacity development, which is a bit of an obscure word, to actually describe the technical assistance or the training that we provide at the request of countries to help them, you know, manage their debt, reorganize their exchange rate mechanisms, restore, you know, sanity in their public finance in general, collect taxation better, set up supervisory authorities that can operate on their financial and banking markets. All sorts of things that have to do with, or you know, put in place a good macroeconomic framework, have good indicators on their fiscal policy, on their monetary policy, and on the structural reforms that are helpful for them. And that is something that it's a bit of the hidden successful story of the IMF in a way, because, you know, I've been doing this job for 7 years and I've never heard any country complain about that technical assistance or that training. And they always want or need more. And the beauty of it is that very often it's financed by the rich countries to the benefit of some of the poorest countries.
Coming up after the break, why women are, at least on one dimension, plainly preferable to men.
I believe that women tend to be more attentive to multiple consequences and developments surrounding particular issues.
That's coming up next on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We're speaking today with the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde.
Okay, d'accord.
In 2016, she was appointed to a second five-year term. It got off to a shaky start with the resolution of a legal issue dating back to her time in French government during the Sarkozy administration. Lagarde was accused of giving preferential treatment to a politically connected French businessman in a case that ended up leaving taxpayers on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars. Finally, she went on trial, taking leave from the IMF, and she was found negligent by the court. But she wasn't fined or given jail time. Nor was there any accusation that Lagarde had gained any personal benefit. She went back to work at the IMF with the full support of the board, as well as world leaders. A few months later, her name was even floated as potential prime minister of France after Emmanuel Macron's election as president. It is hard to imagine any kind of top-tier shortlist anywhere in the world where Lagarde's name would not appear. She's considered fiercely intelligent, principled but pragmatic, a serious-minded person with an impish sense of humor and an ability to make firm demands without bullying. This balance has served her institution well. The world has nearly forgotten that the IMF's previous managing director, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, resigned after being charged with the sexual assault of a housekeeper in a New York City hotel. When Lagarde replaced him in 2011, she became the first woman to lead the IMF. Before that, she was the French finance minister, and before that, chairperson of what was then the world's largest law firm, Baker & McKenzie. Lagarde was the first woman in those jobs as well. I'm guessing it gets tiring being asked questions about being the first something rather than questions about being the something itself. But a question regarding that, how do you believe that economic policymaking over the past, century or so might have been different had there been a lot more women involved in posts at that level?
I happen to think that it would have been a lot different. I said once that if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters, it would be a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that, and I think certainly from my encounters of many women around the world. And I think it's more and more demonstrated by studies and by analytical work. I believe that women tend to be less risk takers, mm-hmm. more attentive to multiple consequences and developments surrounding particular issues. I think by nature, they care about the future because I guess they themselves deliver the future by way of giving birth to the next generation. And I'm not saying that women who have had children are any better than others, but I think it's probably engraved somehow. And I disagree with those of my French favorite authors who say that you are not a mother, but you become a mother. So I also believe that diversity brings a critical component to the decision-making process and helps check conventional wisdom. You know, mm-hmm. when you have a room full of single-gender people, there is an element of group thinking that can be hopefully challenged by having diversity in the room. So two things. One, I believe that women bring about something in and of themselves that is more precautionary maybe and more thoughtful about the future and more concerned about the next generation and what we leave behind. And I also believe that diversity procures that element of second-guessing, thinking through, debating a bit more, which is propitious to better decision-making.
Those are interesting factors. One that you haven't even brought up is, men are responsible for the vast majority of violence in most societies around the world. And you could argue that's a proxy for war making. So theoretically, if war making is one of the most economically costly activities we've done, presumably there might have been a lot less of that over the past century as well.
Possibly, although, I used to think exactly along the lines of what you said. Until eventually I heard and read about, those first female terrorists and female-only terrorists, which was a big letdown to that theory that women are not attracted to violence.
Well, I think that no one said it was exclusively male, but...
No, you're right.
Let's talk for a moment about the relationship between the IMF, which is based in D.C., and the U.S. federal government. So a few years ago, you complained or stated, I should say, that the U.S. had not contributed to the IMF's fundraising, although that's since been rectified, I understand. But additionally, the IMF's positions on trade and climate change and many other issues are almost diametrically opposed to many of President Trump's positions. You've said, for instance, that, I'll quote you to yourself, restricting trade is a clear case of economic malpractice. So I'd love you to describe for me the interactions or conversations you've had with President Trump or his administration about any of these issues.
You know, what I say is very strongly based and rooted in analysis of facts, of numbers, of growth, improvement of economic circumstances, productivity, innovation, and so on and so forth. And we all agree that we want more growth. We all agree that productivity is too low and needs to be improved. We all agree that innovation is necessary. And when you bring that all together and you determine how much trade is or not contributing to that, you very soon realize that trade has actually been a significant factor into innovation, improved productivity, and certainly growth. And that it has combined managed to increase income in many corners of the world, lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty. I'm sure you've heard that a million times. And has reduced basic costs, particularly for low-income consumers. There have been multiple studies on that front. So all of that are, you know, benefits that I don't think many people would argue are actually costs and downside. It's good that there are few people who are starving. It's good that we are more productive. It's good that we are more innovative. And it's good if you can buy a refrigerator or a television set for a much lower price than you had to pay some, I don't know, 20 years ago, everything being equal. Mm-hmm. Having said that, and considering that trade is a major contributor to that, we are also saying that trade has to be conducted with two components in mind. One is it going to benefit everybody, or is it only going to benefit 80% of the population and hurt and possibly hurt badly 20% of the population, or even 10% of the population, or even 5% of the population, because their factory is closing, because the supply chain is reorganized, because innovation is, you know, dislocating the way in which business was conducted. Well, those 5, 10, or 20%, they have to be helped. They have to be looked after, and they have to be ultimately beneficiary of also that innovation, that productivity, and that increased growth. Because you have as much destruction of jobs as you have creation of jobs. The gap between the two is often geography, is often skill set, and is often the ability to actually learn those new things. So that's number one. The second point, which is also a must, is that trade has to be conducted in a loyal and fair way. And that is the commitment that countries make to the multilateral system. If they start using unfair trade practices, I'm not talking about fair competition. The market is such that there is competition, but competition has to be fair. And I think that's also something where we have probably lost a little bit sight of what constitutes fair competition. Is subsidizing electricity, oil, gas, and access to finance, is that a fair way to compete or not, question mark, depending on where you are positioned on the ladder of development?
Yeah, but it's interesting, is it not, that whether the share of people who are disenfranchised, whether it's 5% or 20%, as you were just ballparking there, it's well below the numbers that have turned out to vote against globalization in elections, in or at least to some degree against globalization, or the form of globalization we've ended up with in the U.S., and of course in Brexit. So let me ask you this. Given the long and very poor record of macroeconomic forecasting, including a lot of very poor predictions from the IMF along with everyone else, does it perhaps make sense for the median worker or the median voter to distrust such predictions as Brexit supporters seem to, and look at them instead as, you know, less of an empirical forecast and more of a kind of wish list for the economic and policy elite? I realize that was more of a screed, you know, than a question,
yeah,
but
yeah,
I think
yeah.
you detected a question in there. I apologize.
Yeah, I'll try to address your question, and then I'll defend the institution and its forecasting attempts. Like everybody else's attempts, which is, you know, forecasting is not a mathematics science and is more an art than something else, although there is a huge effort on the part of our teams here to improve and refine. But there are totally unpredictable events, and there are things that we simply do not understand, which are related to human nature, with behavior, as the Nobel jury has recently acknowledged by celebrating and acknowledging the contribution of behavioral economists. But back to your question, which I think is a really interesting one, and where really I want to comment as myself and not as representing the IMF. I am not sure that those economic issues actually mattered that much. I think what was more at the root of some of the votes was the issue of the foreigners, the immigrants, the guys who are coming from somewhere else, who are not us. And there were towns where people said, you know, I want Brexit because I don't want foreigners and I don't want those immigrants to actually take over or be here or take services that are available. So yes, the economic circumstances also mattered. But I think it's a multifaceted explanation. And frankly, I do not see a dichotomy or a disconnect between opening borders and letting goods and services and capital move under fair circumstances and on a level playing field on the one hand, and being attached and cultivating language, civilization, heritage, history, as is, you know, part of our identity.
I realize we're just about out of time. This is a short one. What's something that you believed to be true for a long time until you found out that you were wrong? Or if you don't like that dichotomy of right versus wrong, what's something significant that you really changed your mind about over time?
That's a difficult one.
As it was intended.
You know what? No, there is one thing that totally blew my mind.
Okay.
No, seriously. And I'll go back to women and to gender. I could not believe a study that was produced by our department based on the legal systems of about 150 of our member states. Very thorough study of their constitutional and legal system, where the result of it was that 90%, 90, of those 150 member countries had actually embedded in either their constitution or their legal system discrimination against women. And not the, you know, the teeny tiny, totally irrelevant or trivial discrimination, which even as such would be unacceptable, but major discrimination. I just couldn't believe it.
And you, as a lawyer, trained as a lawyer, not as an economist, you're saying you never would have predicted that had you not known?
No. I would never have thought that it was actually tolerated by, you know, if you look at it, 140 countries around the world have discrimination against women embedded in either their constitution or their legal system in a significant way that actually causes women to be either deprived of land, of title, of heritage, of bank account, of being able to collateralize something and be actual, economic contributor and satisfied human beings if they want to contribute economically.
And at what rate are those restrictions being revoked or overturned?
laboriously, but I make the point as much and as often as I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm glad to finish with that.
Yeah. Madame Lagarde, I thank you so much. It was an honor to speak with you, and I thank you for the time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.